Paper 30, section 1. Okay, and we're into the section a little ways. We're on old single column page 333. And it's that subsection number, Roman numeral number 5. There, about the fragmented entities of deity. Okay, so you recall we got through the big set of lists about the paradise classification. And then we started working into these sort of end notes, in a sense, to that list that they put in here about different categories of beings or sets of beings that they want to mention here, so that you have a sort of everything all in one place, but don't, for various reasons, fit into the paradise classification as they have distilled it here. Remember, we talked about that a lot. You have some, you know, I'm sure inscrutable, vast list that they had to find a way to distill down to some set that, by and large, just involved beings that are revealed in the fifth epical revelation, or at least disclosed in the fifth epical revelation, and yet didn't do any disservice to the truth. And we noticed that a lot of times in the subcategories of beings, they had to throw in, you know, one or two other lines of beings that they haven't revealed, but they wanted to make sure that you at least had a number in that list that fit in with all of the subcategories, so that there's some sort of self-consistent set of numbers of beings in each of those that involves some kind of pattern that wasn't immediately apparent. Most, like we were saying, most likely it's probably speaking to some transfinite patterns, or maybe you should say superfinite patterns, some absonite patterns. But the fact that they went to such effort to do that means that probably at some point in the future, with some effort, we can figure that out. We, you know, humanity can figure that out and get some further recognition of how some of the overarching patterns of the cosmos, in that case it would be the sort of patterns that overarch the whole of the finite, you know, but get projected down into the finite by the master architects as some kind of background patterning of things in which the finite plays out. And then, speaking of the master architects, that was, you know, they were amongst that last group that we talked about, the first of these, you know, little blocks after the lists, the eventuated transcendental beings, and one of which are the architects of the master universe, and then other transcendentalers, other absonite beings that go with them. And then recall, right at the end of that, they were giving us a segue into the next block about fragments, and they reminded us of how we all have an adjuster now, post-Pentecost. We have a fragment. They had kind of a little bit of a poetic flourish there, appealing to us, but the point was that no matter how complicated everything gets in trying to sort out the beings, you know, ones that are absonite, so that technically they're eventuated, in contrast to ones that are finite, who are technically created, or even if they're not eventuated or created, they're fragmented into existence. Regardless, the Father is the initiator of all levels. You know, so that's what they left you with, but God as a Father. In other words, God as the initiator. God the Father as the initiator. So let's look at that very different sort of idea with the fifth epical revelation of how you bring an individuated fact, in this case, not a being, not a person, but an individuated fact, an entity, into existence. Certainly nothing that humans have ever contemplated before. Because, let me just say it up front, because it involves what they try to remind you of right there in that little title, fragmented entities of deity. That contrast, see, we just, how the previous paragraph, God as a superperson, et cetera, is all about God. But that distinction between God and deity, and then once you make that distinction, that you can have an individuation that comes into existence that is not, that you shouldn't think of so much as being an act of God, but rather a functioning of deity. Now, obviously, it's not, God the Father is not schizophrenic when he's doing this. This is all together as one. But, you're thinking much more of these fragments as coming directly from the functioning of deity as opposed to a person's, a creator's hand so immediately. The creator is sort of behind the scenes of the act as opposed to right up front. Okay, so that's what we have. We'll talk a little bit about the deity part of it when we get into it here.
5, fragmented entities of deity. This order of living existence, originating in the Universal Father, is best typified by the thought adjusters, though these entities are by no means the only fragmentations of the pre-personal reality of the first source and center. The functions of the other than adjuster fragments are manifold and little known. Fusion with an adjuster or other such fragment constitutes the creature a father-fused being.
Okay, so this is an important spot because notice what they did there. They tried to remind you, we so often say father-fused mortal, but remember there are other types of father fragments meant for other beings besides mortals, ascending mortals. So that you can use that more generalized expression, father-fused being. As we get into the next ones, you still have just spirit-fused mortals and son-fused mortals to go with the father-fused mortals, but that father-fused, has a more generalized context of father-fused being. Now, think about some of those non-adjuster fragments. They occasionally refer to them. The place you want to immediately think of about that is, or should remember, that to be in the mortal core, one of the mortal cores, you need to have a father fragment fused to you. And if you're not dealing with a mortal, let's say you're dealing with a Havona native, that's even going to be in the core of mortal finality, or an ascendant seraphim, those father fragments that get fused to that Havona native or that seraphim are not adjusters. Those are some of those non-adjuster father fragments. Okay. So, they say they're little known. It's like, they know that much. Now they may not have a lot of sense of, beyond the fact of that, it's not like with an adjuster where you. They have kind of indirectly this whole, way of analyzing that is that adjuster is relating to an ascending mortal, not to mention occasionally those adjusters will get personalized, and then you have a personalized adjuster, and you can get some, direct sense of what's inside a human as a pre-personal fragment. But with those non-adjuster ones, there's probably some, like I was just describing, that they have maybe a little sense of, and then there's probably some that they just suspect exist, but really don't have much in the way of direct evidence at all. Okay. And probably, if they have some suspicion, they're just completely mystified. It's like, wonder what on earth they could even be four. I mean, we don't have any evidence of, you know, some missing piece in the puzzle where we could suspect they go or something, you know. So there's undoubtedly a lot of mystery when it comes to the Father. Now, in terms of the deity, we've pointed this out. Let's just look on the ellipse for it here. God the Father, or the deity part of that, the Father, consists of six different facets. You have the first center, the first source, universal Father, universal Creator, universal Controller, as deity, not as other alternate names from the individuality viewpoint for that individual, but from the deity viewpoint, those are facet names for facets of deity. You have those five, and then you have the infinite upholder. And that facet of deity, you can kind of see just the way you, when you look at it going around the ellipse, it's most removed from this personality end. You know, be it something that kind of has a, you know, that Father personality or that personal face, the universal Father, or the omnipersonal fact underneath that with the first source and center. But way removed from that personality end. You know, lastly, the infinite upholder. You know, remember at the beginning of paper one. See, that's why that fact can be pre-personal. Technically, the way you would want to think about it is it's pre in the sense of top-down. Pre in the sense of like when you think about the three persons and the Paradise Trinity, when you look at it from the top down, you have that non-personalizable deity of the Paradise Trinity that you're seeing from the top down first, and then as a downstepped expression, you have three facets that can be personalized as the three persons. You know, so that the Paradise Trinity in that perspective is pre-personal, if you will, if you're, you know, just in terms of your engagement of looking down from the bottom. Same way here, you can think about it. I mean, the infinite upholder is very directly, literally, on the infinite level. Not, you know, not say down a notch at the co-infinite, but at the infinite level. That it remains there at the infinite level, where you don't want to have any sort of personality encompassing everything, or then you have nothing but God the Infinite. You know, the whole point was to, for the first source and center to, you know, have a sequestration of things so that you could have room for others. But that infinite upholder component stays up there at the infinite level. In direct association with the infinite capacity, and I suppose I remind you that, you know, when we were looking at that, you know, that the infinite capacity in the seventh level is that which extends, and it extends the infinite upholder from the sixth to the seventh, and you have that relationship then between the two and the seventh. You know, so you have these relationships up there in at those highest levels. And you know, sort of apart from where personality can get at it and encompass it, you know, and have just one infinite person filling the whole of the infinite capacity, and that's all there is. It's that facet of deity, of the Father, the infinite upholder, that is individuated, that is fragmented. And you notice when they're talking about it here, you know, remember we're so often, especially early on in the book here, we're so often they're purposely speaking from a seven absolutes of infinity viewpoint, an individuality viewpoint, not bringing in all the complications of deity and reality and all that, you know, of total deity. You know, and so first they say originating in the universal Father, but then they sort of nudge it a little bit more and they say pre-personal reality, the first source and center. I mean, they're kind of encourage you eventually to recognize specifically what part of God the Father, what part of the Father, that it's a fragment of the deity of the infinite upholder, that type of Father deity, the infinite upholder type, that is being individuated. And, you know, it's a process of, you know, putting together all the pieces in the revelation that finally gets you to that recognition. You know, it's certainly not right in front of us here that you can see that. But that's an important point to kind of have in mind to better appreciate what they're just about to talk about. If you have an initial sense of what kind of deity is being fragmented to make these entities, that it's the infinite upholder, you have the beginnings of a recognition of what's going on a little bit more with the sun-fused and the spirit-fused ones. So read both of those paragraphs in about those two.
The fragmentations of the pre-mind spirit of the third source and center, though hardly comparable to the father fragments, should be here recorded. Such entities differ very greatly from adjusters. They do not, as such, dwell on Spiritington, nor do they, as such, traverse the mind gravity circuits. Neither do they indwell mortal creatures during the life in the flesh. They are not pre-personal in the sense that the adjusters are, but such fragments of pre-mind spirit are bestowed upon certain of the surviving mortals, and fusion therewith constitutes them spirit-fused mortals in contradistinction to adjuster-fused mortals. Still more difficult of description is the individualized spirit of a creator son, union with which constitutes the creature a sun-fused mortal, and there are still other fragmentations of deity.
Okay. So now with those two, I mean, the very fact that they're giving you, you know, saying something about them right here, you know, should be here recorded, they said. See, that's a clue. They're wanting you to think about beginning to understand what the relationship is. And they give you another hint. Instead of saying pre-personal, they say pre-mind. Now, in both cases, they notice they call it a pre-mind spirit, and of course, we often, you know, speak of the father fragments, the adjusters, as spirit fragments. So you have this expression of thinking about taking the unity which is deity, fragmenting it, and it's like, well, so now you have this little, you know, nugget of that unity likeness. Well, unity likeness is, you know, what's the basic nature of spirit as a substance? You know, it's the substance that expresses unity, in contrast to matter, that's the substance that expresses individuality. So you can see, and it's in that sense, they're calling it a spirit fragment. You know, it's this fragment of the unity that is deity, so it is very unity-like. It's a spirit fragment. Now we know that's a relative designation. Like for instance, with the adjuster is just as much pure energy as it is pure spirit. See, so it isn't just, you know, merely a quote unquote spirit fragment, but in terms of how it relates to us, especially initially, it's as if it's just this pure spirit, you know, fragment. So that's why they call it that. And they're saying that these other fragments work in the same way. Okay, so now, if they, you know, really should be here recorded, what exactly is the basic sense? Well, once you start, you know, get through total deity, once you start unpacking the deity and how this all works, you come to recognize that the most immediate way that you can begin to talk about the type of deity that is the mother is in speaking of its upholder aspect, the mother as an upholder. And so, for instance, when we talk about the universal mother, the mother relative to the grand universe, that upholder aspect, you can call the universal mother the finite upholder, capital F, capital U. In other words, a downstepped expression of the infinite upholder. Okay? It's like, huh. So if a father fragment is a fragment of the infinite upholder, oh, I'm getting it. So what these fragments are, that go for spirit-fused mortals and sun-fused mortals, those are mother fragments in contrast to father fragments. And even calling it a father fragment is kind of quote-unquote, I mean, yes, it's a fragment of the deity that is the father, but in terms of the way we initially think about that, the infinite upholder is up at that level that's above the distinction between father and mother. It's up at the infinite level. You know, one way you can think about conceptual beginning, instead of saying in the conceptual beginning was the I am, you can take that tack where you say in the conceptual beginning was God the infinite, and then you downstepped that, you bifurcate that so that there can be other, not just that one fact, God the infinite. You downstep that, bifurcate that into God the Father and God the Mother. See, so that technically, so that infinite is a super father-mother distinction. The infinite upholder is the father as the mother. In other words, yeah, it's also the mother as the father. I mean, okay. But if you downstep that infinite upholder, you have these fragments. And think about in this sense what these fragments represent. You're giving a being the ability to uphold itself to some degree. You really see that very definitively with us getting a father fragment. Where right now, I'm within the womb of the Creative Mother Spirit. I'm very dependent in almost everything you can think of on her upholding me for me to be an ongoing phenomenon. Maintain me. I need to be upheld in almost every way. Eventually, when I get to be a first stage spirit, I have a little bit measure of self-upholding. I can uphold now by myself the things that she was formerly holding very directly. I still can't uphold everything. I go into the reflective mother spirit's womb of the super universe, and they uphold the things that I can't yet uphold. But see, on it goes. There's a degree to which you're being given the potential to uphold yourself some. As a downstepped expression of the infinite upholder, that facet of deity, the label they give for that facet of deity is self-experiential deity. See, think about this, how we're talking about this self-upholding to a degree that we're, rising up to. So, I mean, that's the initial way that you can just kind of categorize it. You have father fragments and mother fragments. And when you recognize that, then you zero in very clearly on understanding the sun fused. So, but let's start with the spirit fused. So there you have a creative mother spirit in some local universe. Okay? And there's a fragment of the kind of deity that goes into the mother, part of that is upholder deity, that's being fragmented and given to a mortal. So that if they're going to be a spirit-fused mortal, they got an adjuster temporarily on their mortal sphere, on their origin sphere, got an initial soul. They're resurrected on the first mansion world. And right there, given one of these spirit fragments, these mother fragments of the creative mother spirit, it's fused to them. Right there, when they wake up. Okay, so that, and what that is, like they're saying is, and that it has a similarity to being pre-personal, as being pre-mind. Okay, how can you think about that? Well, that's why I did that whole bit about looking at it from the top down. If you think about the infinite upholder, or now we're remembering you can have down the Trinity can downstep to expressions of that, the functioning of the Trinity as the Trinity of absoluteness, the Trinity of ultimacy, the Trinity of supremacy, that can get downstepped from the infinite level. Okay? That But just, you know, the infinite upholder, when you're looking at, that's what you see from the unity viewpoint. If you flip it around to the individuality viewpoint, which of the seven absolutes is that? The infinite upholder on one side, which absolute is it on the other side? You remember?
I don't want to say conjoint, but...
No. You've got, is it the deity absolute, the unqualified absolute, or the universal absolute?
The universal absolute.
Yep, it's the universal absolute. Okay.
Trying to turn it twice.
Right. The universal absolute is what you have on the other side, you know, as it were, the other viewpoint, fundamental viewpoint, the individuality viewpoint of the infinite upholder, the universal absolute. Well, when we think about the absolutes, you know, those three absolutes that I just mentioned, deity, unqualified, universal, then we think of those as reservoirs of potential. And the universal absolute is a reservoir of the potential for mind energy. See, so think about that. If you're looking at the top down, just top down, and you have the infinite upholder or downstepped expressions, that's sort of pre-mind, pre-kind of getting all the way down here, and then in the individuality viewpoint where everything is flipped around, and then mind wells up out of that reservoir when it's, you know, when that potential is actualized. See, that's the sense of pre-mind. You know, it's a fragment of deity, you know, and so, I mean, in general, deity is pre-matter, pre-mind, pre-spirit. So that's why they're saying it that way. Again, to you know, give you these clues so that you can begin to put this together. So, you know, the creative mother spirit not only has the type of deity called the spirit in her nature, but she has the type of deity called the mother in her nature. That's why she's the creative mother spirit, not just the creative spirit. So she can bestow a mother fragment like this to these spirit-fused mortals. The next notch up, you have the reflective mother spirits. And remember, we pointed this out. It's a little more complicated at the super-universe level. You have you have seven spirits. You have seven measures of the spirit type deity with some complications, but you know, just keep it simple. But there's just one mother. They come together as one mother, seven spirits. There is one mother because, you know, a single super universe is just a single universe. It's a single mother domain. It's not set. It's, you know, a super universe isn't sevenfold. There are seven super universes, but one of them is, you know, is not sevenfold. It's one universe. It's one mother. Right. So there is one type of mother deity, a higher type of mother deity, not so downstepped mother deity, that makes them together, the reflective mother spirits, and a fragment of that mother deity, again, in this upholder sense, is what's being bestowed on a sun-fused mortal. Now, why is it called sun-fused? Because remember, not only is it a mother, but there's this reflective ability that we talked about so much when we talked about the Sakanafim, you know, the daughters of the reflective mother spirits. So when they individuate this fragment to fuse with a sun-fused mortal, this mother fragment, they reflectively synchronize it to the creator sun of the local universe that you came up from. You know, in the same way that you can have, a void, one of those Sakanafim can be a voice of one of those creator suns, you know, reflectively, like we talked about. Or in the exact same way they point out that once you leave the local universe, you can still be encircled in the spirit of truth because that spirit ministry can be poured out upon that higher spirit substrate of the reflective mother spirits because of that reflective synchronization ability that they have. They can reflect within their substrate what every spirit of truth from every local universe is going to need to also be poured out upon that substrate. So all the, you know, it's all the same thing. This, so they have this reflective ability to precisely synchronize with a creator sun, and they're bestowing a mother fragment. Yeah. So that's, you know, so they, still more difficult of description. Yeah, I mean, I had to go through a lot more because it's a lot more complicated with the seven reflective spirits, but one mother, and, you know, et cetera, and all this. Okay, but, you know, you can pick your way through that when you know that the whole point is just to understand how, you know, you're getting a particular type of mother fragment as opposed to father fragment.
I hope you don't ever ask us to explain that in a class.
I won't, but someone on the Mansion Worlds will. So, you know, you can figure it out now. Okay, so that's... So that's the basic thing to think about. And when you, once you begin to get that sense, when you take that recognition, that budding recognition of how this works with fragments, you take that into unpacking the central universe, and you make some very interesting discoveries about the whole pattern that this is a part of. And in that pattern, out comes who the Midsoniters are. It begins with this. All right. We'll notice them in passing here coming up shortly. But all right. So this, you now have a kind of a different appreciation. You know, it's not so much... really father-son spirit at all. It's really all about the infinite upholder and downstepped expressions of the infinite upholder. It's either the father as the mother or directly the mother, you know, when you go below the infinite level. That's what these fragments are about. You can fragment things like this, you know, have it not be a person, you know, not have it sort of like instantly require personalization, because it's that part that's sort of the farthest removed from the absolute grip of personalization at the other end of the father. It's shades of what got liberated within the fullness of the I Am. When you got the part that just has to be very definitively, right up front, personalized, done, then this other stuff was free to take on a role like this, free to become, you know, the fragment within you, free to make you a part of eternity. All right, now, another little, even more other category.
Six superpersonal beings. There is a vast host of other than personal beings of divine origin and of manifold service in the universe of universes. Certain of these beings are resident on the paradise worlds of the sun. Others, like the superpersonal representatives of the eternal sun, are encountered elsewhere. They are, for the most part, unmentioned in these narratives, and it would be quite futile to attempt their description to personal creatures.
Okay, but, you know, they don't just say, okay, and then there's those entities or whatever we want to call them on the sun's world that we don't even, you know, even the revelators don't understand. Remember, there is something that they do have a little bit more understanding of. There's these so-called spirit, superpersonal spirit representatives of the eternal sun. And when they say are encountered elsewhere, do you remember where? We saw them in passing back when we were going through the cosmology. We were on a very high architectural sphere, and there was a whole bunch of kind of these others, and they were there.
Vice chair.
Well, yeah, along with things like that. Yeah, which sphere was that? Was that Fallington? Was that? Uversa. I mean, up on Uversa. Okay. You'll run across a whole bunch of these. very different sorts of facts, like the superpersonal spirit representatives of the Eternal Son. Okay, and remember, back in the Eternal Son papers, when they mention them, they say, well, I guess we're going to have to use the word superpersonal to describe them. Because I couldn't think of any other word to use. But you got to remember, this is an exception. I mean, normally when you say superpersonal, what you mean by that is what you do to an absentite being that's equivalent to a finite being being personalized. An absentite being is superpersonalized as a superpersonality. That's, you know, basically what, you know, so like, for instance, the architects of the Master Universe, those are super personalities, okay, in the normal sense. These beings, you know, and even using the word being is, you know, it's just as fuzzy as using the word personal, even super personal. Everything about the use of language is, you know, kind of fuzzed in order to give them some label. I mean, these are finite entities, beings, other than personal something or others, okay? They're finite. They're not absentite. They're not absolute or, you know, anything else. And they told you that back in the... So this is a very mysterious thing. You've got something that is, in some sense, apparently, quote-unquote, personalized, but it's not... It doesn't seem that way, as it should if it's a finite fact that's getting personalized. It should be quite definitively personal, and yet it's very fuzzily so. It's some sort of way above, and yet not. It's also down here at eye level. Okay, so you just remember that when you run across that, that's a special use of super personal for these quote unquote beings. And so you have. You know, you have this engagement from both all three circuits, paradise circuits, you know, the Father's worlds, the Son worlds, and the Spirit's worlds. All three of those circuits, in their way, are involved in what's going on in the seven super universes. And it's, to the extent to which we know about this, this is the, all we know about how the Son's worlds are somehow interplaying with what's going on out here is through these superpersonal spirit representatives of the Eternal Son. Okay, so those are very much a special little category of beings mentioning here. What do we have next here?
Seven unclassified and unrevealed orders. During the present universe age, it would not be possible to place all beings, personal or otherwise, within classifications pertaining to the present universe age. Nor have all such categories been revealed in these narratives. Hence, numerous orders have been omitted from these lists. Consider the following. The consummator of universe destiny, the qualified vicegerents of the ultimate, the unqualified supervisors of the supreme, the unrevealed creative agencies of the ancients of days, Magistan of paradise, the unnamed reflectivator liaisons of Magistan. The Midsonite orders, how do you want to say that word? Midsonite orders of the local universes.
Okay. So, really other, assorted others, you know, now. Okay, so notice the heading first, unclassified and unrevealed orders. Okay, so, like we were stressing again at the beginning, that's one of the issues with what they did to the paradise classification. You know, it got really circumscribed in order to kind of boil it down to basically what they're revealing in the fifth epical revelation. But there's a handful of beings that have to be disclosed. By and large, you can't reveal a lot about most of them, some more than others, but They have to be disclosed, because if they aren't, again, you're going to be missing a key element. There's no way you'll be able to make a self-consistent picture out of the fifth epical revelation if you're missing these beings. And you discover that quickly. When the very as soon as you get started with unpacking total deity, the very first thing that you know kind of puts a keystone in place in locking that picture together into something that you can continue to drive forward is you have to know about the consummator of universe destiny. Very key. Just like with the architects of the master universe. I mean, there is an analog between the two of them. They're related in a way that is very important to understand and to have in the picture. And a lot of times when they mention the consummator in the context of the absolute Trinity, remember, you know, when they're talking about the absolute Trinity, God the Supreme, God the Ultimate, and the consummator of universe destiny, the three elements of that absolute Trinity, they will actually say the unrevealed consummator of universe destiny. I'll actually put it in the name to remind you what they just did here. You know, that they disclose that fact, but, and they give you the one tidbit that's the third element of the absolute Trinity, but that's it. However, of course, in the process of that, that's telling you, like they point out in the book, that you know that's a co-absolute being. You know, so like the architects are absonite beings, the consummator is a co-absolute being. Because that's the association in the absolute Trinity. That's a co-absolute association. Just like there's an absonite association in the ultimate Trinity. Okay. So there's the consummator. And then the qualified vicegerents of the ultimate. Give you a few little tidbits about them. The unqualified supervisors of the supreme, they give you a little bit more about them. Those are basically the deputies of the supreme being. You know, so those are antecedent followings. Those are beings that are down, you know, in the finite here, that can only exist after the finite is complete, technically, from a bottom-up point of view. You know, they're very definitively only understandable from a top-down point of view, where you already have the supreme being and you have his deputies. They're unqualified. Now, you know, so you have to have the fullness of supremacy in play for them to be unqualified to come into existence. But qualified vicegerents of the ultimate, so that's, you know, the distinction there, that does have a relativity. You don't have to have the fullness of God the ultimate, or the ultimate one, relative to them. And then you have the unrevealed, quote-unquote, creative agencies of the ancients of days. And, you know, and like I've pointed out, when you put together the psychic circles in the sevenfold chart here so that you can see the fullness of that sevenfold hierarchy, and you have that column for the cosmic mothers, you know, and remember there's our, you know, when we're thinking about the psychic circles when you fuse and you're at psychic circle zero, you know, you're fusing with a fragment of the infinite upholder like we were just talking about, you know, and down step there's the finite upholder like we were mentioning. But at that level of the collective super universe level, who's the mother at that collective super universe level? Whose womb are you in as a finaliter? You know, once you've gone above being in the womb of the reflective mother spirits, you've transcended the distinction between the super universes. Creative mother spirits, creative agencies, hint, hint. Right? You know, they're trying to get you to eventually put that piece together and recognize that's, you know, because if you start thinking about it logically, it's like, wait a minute, there has to be another mother because I'm not all the way up to the supreme level. I can't be in that, you know, womb. I don't have supreme mind. There's got to be a mother between, you know, see, there they are. So you can just, you know, I'm kind of immediately showing you, you know, why they had to disclose it, because otherwise, if I tried to make this chart, I'd have a blank line there. You know, and I could dream up something, but I want you to call them creative mother agencies of the ancients of days. And a way you can think about, remember we were just focusing on how in the previous one, or in the two ones back with the fragments, you know, this is about deity. That you have, once you're thinking in terms of deity, you can understand that it's like, why, when I'm talking about the supreme creators, I put the master spirits above the Ancients of Days. When I'm talking about the mother hierarchy there, I'm putting the creative mother agencies of the Ancients of Days above the reflective mother spirits of the master spirits. Why is it flipped here? Because when you're talking about the supreme creators, okay, you're talking about God, the personalized deity and what it's doing, the master spirits as persons, the Ancients of Days as persons. And in that sense, the master spirits as persons are above the Ancients of Days as persons. Okay, but when you're talking about mother, the mothers that are associated with them, that's a deity relationship. And the deity of the seven master spirits, remember, there's seven distinct downstep flavors of deity that are different, that define the difference of the seven super universes. You know, yes, the personalities of the seven master spirits are unique, but their deity is also different too. It's a downstep, it's a sevenfold individuation of deity. The deity of the Ancients of Days is not different. All 21 has the exact same deity. See, that's a non-downstepped deity. It's at a higher level. So the mother, the deity phenomenon, you know, that's related to that deity phenomenon is above. And we talked about that a lot, you know, a lot, how, you know, occasionally you got to remember that the Ancients of Days as deity, you know, are functioning above what the master spirits can do as deity, because they're downstepped and localized, you know, individuated to just be relative to one super universe. They can't be relative to all seven.
Or functional?
Well, I mean, all deity is functional, but just, I mean, it's just more specific. You know, there's, you know, each time you downstepped, you're going from unity, heading towards individuality, you know, as you downstep. And so, you know, that very, very pure unity that is deity at the highest level gets downstepped and more individuated, you know, as it goes down. By the time you get down to deity at the level of the super universes, look how, you know, how individuated it is. You know, it's not just one creator son or something, you know. It's all these different flavors. And okay? So it's getting very down, very individuated as it's downstepped. So those are the, and they give you, like I mentioned a time or two ago, you know, they do give you a little passing clue about one thing that they do, besides being this mother that we're deducing here. They're one of the parents of the Abaddonners. Reflective mother spirits and the reflective mother agencies, you know, both there on the super universe capital, work together to make Abaddonners. Okay, and then Magistan, you know, we have a fair amount about Magistan. You know, so that's, you know, that's revealed to, you know, a degree. Obviously, they don't tell you everything. There's some very important things that you can eventually unpack about Magistan when you're unpacking the central universe, but they give you a lot to go on to begin with there. Now, the other one, the unnamed reflective Vader liaisons of Magistan. Unnamed in the sense of these aren't technically capitalized. You know, if you find them referred to somewhere in the text, you'll see this is not a proper name. And they'll call them either reflectivator liaisons, no capital letters, or liaison reflectivators. Again, no capitals. That's the unnamed. They don't want to pin it down to proper name, you know, with capital letters and beginning the words. They want to keep that one purposely just descriptive. That's the unnamed. You know, and why totally? Well, the first thing you can obviously notice is that they do it the two different ways. They want you to be able to at least think about them as reflectivator liaisons on the one hand and liaison reflectivators on another hand. And it's like, wow, what's the difference there? Well, see, I mean, you know, start reflecting, you know, thinking about that, and you begin to get a distinction. You know, is the key that they're doing the reflectivity thing, or is it the key that they're a liaison to Magistan, which is the important thing that you're talking about? Okay. And then the Mincenites, Mincenite orders, the Mincenators. Like you can kind of tell what I was talking about, the place you, you when you You need the consummators to really kind of get the process going of unpacking deity. You bring in the creative mother agencies before too long. You don't really have a lot to say about the other ones in this list until you really get to unpacking the central universe, and then you discover very definitively how all these things fit together in the system. And sure enough, see, you go, oh, that's why the midsonators are in that list. Because in the process of really definitively understanding the reflectivator liaisons and the unqualified supervisors and the qualified vicegerents and all that, there's the midsonators too in the same picture. That's why they're here. In a seemingly as a non sequitur relative to the consummator of universe destiny. But these are key beings that they didn't want you to coin some name. They at least wanted to give you a label like reflectivator liaison. They knew you would need these beings to understand, to have a consistent picture at some point. And and so that's what they really have in common, is that they're, you know, you're going along, it's like, okay, so there's a being that fits in, there's a puzzle, you know, I have a puzzle piece right here. So there's a being that, oh, those are the reflectivator liaisons. Oh my goodness. See, I mean, that's what you actually do. You're going, you know, because I don't know about you, but for years, me reading this list, I'm thinking, reflectivator liaisons. Okay, who could ever figure that out? How inscrutable is that? I mean, and I'm just merrily chugging along, and it's like, yeah, I mean, you know you got a being here, and it's like, well, who are they? Oh, they're them. You know, the fact that they gave you the name or, you know, this label, you know. You're going, well, they're a being that's in liaison with Magiston, and they're related to reflectivity. Who are they? Huh. It just is very obvious.
That hadn't come up for me yet.
Right. And see, it's only when you are going way down the line with unpacking this stuff.
No, I noticed they didn't enumerate this list.
Right. But
there does happen to be seven.
There does. which we'll really see when we get to the next list. The ubiquity of seven. Okay. So I know I belabored that a bit, but I just wanted to give you some, you know, at least something to kind of whet your appetite. Because you appreciate why this is here. It's because they're giving you these key elements so that you can eventually really put together a self-consistent picture. All right.
No special significance need attach to the listing of these orders together, except that none of them appear in the Paradise classification as revealed herein. These are the unclassified few. You have yet to learn of the unrevealed many.
Remember, like, is that, there's a, yeah, an uncountable number that weren't in the Paradise list.
There are spirits, spirit entities, spirit presences, personal spirits, pre-personal spirits, super-personal spirits, spirit existences, spirit personalities, but neither mortal language nor mortal intellect are adequate. We may, however, state that there are no personalities of pure mind. No entity has personality unless he is endowed with it by God, who is spirit. Any mind entity that is not associated with either spiritual or physical energy is not a personality. But in the same sense that there are spirit personalities who have mind, there are mind personalities who have spirit. Magiston and his associates are fairly good illustrations of mind-dominated beings, but there are better illustrations of this type of personality unknown to you. There are even whole unrevealed orders of such mind personalities, but they are always spirit-associated. Certain other unrevealed creatures are what might be termed mindal and physical energy personalities. This type of being is non-responsive to spirit gravity, but is nonetheless a true personality, is within the Father's circuit.
This is a very important paragraph in the book that when you start getting into the details, you often refer back to, you know, in the midst of all this, all these lists and stuff, is this, you know, this is a big paragraph too. This is a real juicy one. Let's unpack it a little bit here. As long as we were talking about it. So when they say Magistan and his associates, who are his associates?
The reflective
analytical. Yes, right. So that list, it starts it out. Let's bring in some examples so it isn't so abstract. Okay, so spirit entity. Well, maybe the first thing you might think of is, thought adjuster. But we're going to have pre-personal spirits. So let's save thought adjusters for pre-personal spirits. Well, let's see, I suppose I could call one of those quote-unquote pre-mind spirits a spirit entity. Or even something like, say, an inspired Trinity spirit. Mm-hmm. They say those may be something kind of like those super personal eternal sun, for all intents and purposes, practically, it's kind of just a spirit entity. There's nothing definitively personal that engages you, with an inspired Trinity spirit. So that, you could use them as an example too. Spirit presence, just like, for instance, the spirit presence of the Eternal Mother Son that fills this room and all of infinity. That's a spirit presence, okay? It's not a concept, it's literal. There's literal spirit energy that's present, that is literally the presence of the Eternal Mother Son. There can be that presence, ubiquitous presence in here, because it's not just the Eternal Son, a point individual standing on the aisle, is the Eternal Mother Son. So there can be a ubiquity associated, a spirit presence. And that's even out here. So that's a spirit presence. Personal spirit, like a personalized adjuster. It's like, well, why'd you pick that, Chris? Why not something else? Like, well, you'll see in a second. They're talking about something that's just a spirit fragment, not other things, and that's personalized. So, remember, like even we talked about the master spirits, we were pointing out, if they're going to give rise to the seven supreme power directors, those quasi-material, they can't be just pure spirit. There has to be some other stuff there. So, you wouldn't want to call them personal spirits, quote unquote. Pre-personal spirits, like the adjusters or father fragments, super personal spirits. We saw some, we were just talking about them some, like those super personal spirit representatives of the Eternal Son. Spirit existences. Okay, now this literally, like the stuff that they build buildings out of on architectural world, spirit, substance, just stuff. Or the literal spirit energy that they lay out in a line to form half of the mind conduit, for the communication grid, and literal, just spirit substance existences, and then spirit personalities. See, so here you have, personal spirits and spirit personalities. That's the contrast. Okay, like I said, that first one, that's where you're basically thinking you just have this spirit substance is personalized. But by spirit personality, you see what that means as you start reading in. Where they're talking about that there are no personalities of pure mind, no entity has personality unless he's endowed with it by God who is spirit. Any mind entity that's not associated with either spiritual or physical energy is not a personality. Okay, so in other words, you have some sort of an energy system, be it material, mindal, spiritual energy, and whatever mix or in whatever form, whatever. You have some sort of actuality, some sort of an energy system that in that sense is just an entity, but you're going to personalize it and make it a being, make it a personality, quote unquote. Okay, but the question is, so that being, does it basically put forward a spirit face? Even though there's some other energies involved in its nature, or does it basically put forward a material face, like us? We're very much material personalities. We put forward a material face. A master spirit is a spirit personality. They very much put forward a spirit face. That that recessive stuff that gives, we were just talking about, that can give rise in offspring, can come out in offspring. See, that's, you know, that's not, that's hidden behind their face, their spirit face. You know, they really put, so that's what they're saying. You know, do you have a being that might be a spirit personality, or they might be, like they say there in the next sentence, mind personalities? So you have a being that, for instance, there's some mind and spirit energy there, but they really put a mind face forward, not a spirit face forward. Yeah.
It's mentioned on page 334, section 2.
Yeah, that's where we are.
Oh, I know, but this is on page 1225.
Oh, well, 1220.
Yeah, personality survival.
What are you looking at there?
Fill that in.
1225.
1225, personality survival, all the way down, number 2, it may be bestowed upon any living energy system,
right,
which includes mind or spirit.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Right, so yeah, what Don is pointing out there is when they're talking about personality survival, at the beginning of the personality survival paper, they have a description about personality, and there's a bullet point that basically is related to just what we're talking about here. That now, obviously, I can't just be a blob of matter and be personalized. I have to be minded. Okay, so you can take a physical identity that's minded and personalize it. Or you can just take some spirit energy, personalize it. And the key they're trying to point out, see, you know, there has to be either spiritual or physical energy, because there's just two substances. I mean, this is the way you can really kind of pin it down. You know, you have matter, you know, material substance and spirit substance, but you don't want to say you have mind substance. Mind energy, don't use the word the noun substance for that, because this is where you're seeing that. It's just not that foundational, where it can literally conserve as, just in and of itself, as the body of a person, what stands under the substance of that person. And so you have two substances, three energies.
But the material can take different, material substance in a Maranja state or out of paradise, I say it's material. It's different than material, right?
Well, it's material energy. And what do you mean by material energy in general, or even more general, physical energy? You mean an energy where its fundamental quality is individuality, as opposed to spirit energy where its fundamental quality is unity. And it's like, well, that's pretty abstract. Well, yeah, it is. It's so abstract because I can't stub my toe against spirit substance. Yes, once I can stub my toe against spirit substance, this won't be so abstract. I'll appreciate this, but I know that's what I will discover eventually, because that's the distinction.
Material different substance too?
For instance, a photon is material energy. Electromagnetic phenomena are material energy. Okay, so it doesn't have to just be, you know, atoms, you know, or whatever, electrons or protons. Okay, in general, you have physical energy. Okay, and sometimes when they're like, when you get to the triunities, the two words they'll use to talk about the two sides, they'll say spirit and energy. There they use the word energy rather than matter, as the word that's in contrast to spirit as a substance, as an actuality.
Yeah, because they say, I think it's in paper on the Isle of Paradise, they say, remember, spirit things are real.
Right. That's why I keep saying spirit substance, okay? I mean, it's literal, okay?
Theoretically, just like we have experienced real on a material plane, you experience real on a spiritual plane. It's just,
but again, little, you know, instead of thinking of in planes, like, you know, that historical language.
Well, for me, that's good enough.
Well, but they're trying to challenge us to not think of it just that way. If for no other reason, when you get up to the upper surface of paradise, there's one plane there.
I got to start somewhere.
I know. But I'm just challenging you to take the next step, right?
I'll take the first step.
You know, that from a top-down point of view, to think about matter and spirit as on the same plane. When we're down here as material creatures, immersed, you know, in a predominantly almighty supreme domain, we experience matter at eye level on our plane, and the next plane up is mind, and the next plane up is spirit. That's an experiential hierarchy from the perspective of a finite being. From the perspective of the absolute, they're not stacked like that. Matter, mind, and spirit are all on the same plane. The absolute spirit standing next to the absolute mind, you know, on the absolute of matter. I mean, they're all on the same plane on the absolute level.
I mean, I can intellectualize that. Mm-hmm. I just can't experientialize.
You can't experience that, but you can existentialize that, in a sense. You know, if you can use
for me, but maybe different than it is.
But see, that's the relatives are trying to get us to not just be limited to how we immediately experience the threefold actuality. Okay, but anyway, let's not get too far afield there. No. But anyway, so this is what they're talking about. So you have various energy systems that are personalized, and just the question is, how are you going to refer to them? Well, if they put a predominantly a spirit face forward, call them a spirit personality. If they predominantly put a mind face forward, call them a mind personality. If they're an absentite blend, down towards the end there, if it's an absentite blend of mindal and physical energy that's personalized, you know, then you could call them a mindal hyphen and physical hyphen energy personality. Okay, that's what they're doing there. They're alluding at the end there to remember that it's, you know, just to say it's a physical personality or a mind personality or a spirit personality, that's a pretty finite point of view. That's the first two triodities.
But this is not just limiting it to absentite personalities. There could be finite.
No. Yeah, there are. Yeah, I'm not saying they're absentite personalities. It's an absentite blend of energy. For instance, the seraphim is an absentite blend of energy. It's not like the Marantia, where the physical energy and the spirit energy are still distinct. You know, it's a heterogeneous weave where if you zoomed in with a microscope, you can point at a physical energy fiber, you know, and you can point at a spirit energy fiber. If you zoom in on a seraphim's body with a high-powered microscope, you don't see material and physical energy separate. Physical and spirit energy separate. It's homogeneously blended together. It's like, well, how do you know? Well, if it didn't have some physical energy, some individuality-like energy blended into it, all the revelators would talk about seraphim like they talk about those beings on the Eternal Sun's worlds as inscrutable, pure spirit things. It's like, well, okay, that's pure unity, so it's nonsensical to talk about it being individuated. How can you talk about it being a being? I mean, that's, you know, a seraphim is located within a certain box because they have individuality nature. They're individuated relative to the aisle. They have physical energy so that they're
on a head of a pin.
No, they occupy space. So a certain number fit on a head of a pin, and, you know, not very many, obviously. How many of us can stand on a head of a pin? Not many. They occupy space just like we do. Okay, they're not immaterial. See, that whole how many angels can dance on the head of the pin, that's because historically you thought in dichotomies where you assumed if it wasn't material, and no one wanted to make an angel material, therefore it's immaterial, which means it has no relationship to space, so an infinite number could stand on the head of a pin. No, that's not what the revelation tells us. They're not immaterial. They have lots of material energy in them. They're not that far above us. They're basically our amount of physical energy with a little bit of spirit energy blended in homogeneously with it. Okay, now if you go up a lot higher, there's a lot more spirit energy blended in. But a seraphim just has a little bit of spirit energy blended in to the physical energy. So they have a very definitive volume in space. And You're not going to get more than one of them on a head of a pin. You're not going to get any of them. None of us can stand on a head of a pin. You're not going to stand an angel on a head of a pin either. Okay. They occupy space.
Can seraphim somehow alter its mix and become visible for a short time?
No. See, that's the fancy thing about especially secondary midwares. The kind of energy system that they are has this knob, where they can dial themselves up and down in this vertical spectrum a little bit.
Weren't some beings made visible to when Jesus was talking?
Right, that's the master physical controllers can make you a hologram projection. They can sort of encase you in visible energy. It's hollow. When you're seeing Gabriel visualized for you like that, you're just seeing a skin of energy that the master physical controllers have wrapped around him. You're not actually seeing him. Now that skin, they're obviously are going to make it have some sort of reflection of his nature, or if for no other reason they couldn't match it up to him if it didn't have some relationship to his energy nature, but effectively it's just it's like wrapping him in skin so that we can see him.
Is that what they did when Jesus
came? Yeah, and on the Transfiguration, they wrap him in this energy skin, and it's a high energy skin.
So don't touch me?
Well, that's different. Okay. No, not with Jesus Maranja, but that's a little different. But on the Mount of Transfiguration,
okay.
They're wrapping him in this energy skin. These are very high beings. So this is a very high energy skin that they're wrapping around them. And it's literally ionizing the air, You got St. Elmo's fire going on, off of this thing. I'm sure the ozone was heavy on top of the mountain that day. Okay, right?
Please,
that's what's going on. Okay. But with Jesus, the thing about whether or not he wants someone to touch him or something, it's how definitively they are making him tangible, the master physical controllers. In those early stages, he was just sort of being quasi-visualized, and he didn't want to freak him out because of their hand going through him, but obviously, sometimes, he's literally grabbing hold of the bread with the brothers, on the road to Emmaus. There he's, you could have touched him and it would have been fine. They were very definitively expressing him so that he wasn't freaky.
One other question here.
Yep.
It talks about this pure mind in quotes.
Yeah.
Is that basically saying that there really is no just pure mind being like you might see on Star Trek or something like that? There's no just a mind being. Every being has some kind of form that has personality, or there's no being without
that. What they mean is that if you just think in finite terms, we have three different energies and they're distinct. You have spirit energy, mind energy, and material energy. You can't just take that mind energy, and mold it like you're molding clay into a body for a being and personalize it, because it's too mushy. It doesn't hold it. It's not a substance.
Yeah.
It's a relationship between two substances. It's more like a fluid than a solid, especially when you're thinking about trying to make a body out of it. It would be like trying to make a fluid being instead of a solid being.
You think the Father has a form?
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah. It's saying, of course, it's a very high form that we can't experience, but yeah, he definitely has a form. There's only a handful of beings that they reveal that from a finite perspective don't have form. But again, that's just from a finite perspective. If you went up a notch, they would have form. All the way up to the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, those beings have form. It's just a very, very high form that you're not going to be able to experience any more than you can experience the form of even a solitary messenger right now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or an adjuster before it's personalized or fuses. They're formless in terms of experientially, but they obviously can't be literally formless, or they couldn't be a fragment. obviously they have a form, or the word fragment is nonsensical. It's just that's a form that's transcendent of our ability to experience its boundaries. So it just seems to be everywhere and nowhere. Okay, so yeah, so that's what they're trying to get you to understand. Like I said, there's two substances, three energies, but two substances, and you really see it here. You can't make a body out of just mind energy. It won't hold a form, you know, in a sense, see?
There's not a physics like there is with the other things that are substance.
Yeah, there's something that's, that's more solid-like, see, than liquid-like, in a sense, about spirit and matter. Obviously about matter, but also about spirit, that you can think about it just as literally as this, that you can, make bricks out of spirit that are a certain dimension, and they hold that dimension, and, it's a literal substance.
Spirit existence.
Yeah, that's spirit existences, right. Okay, so, so whether it's a high or a low being, you can have, a blend of physical and mindful energy, see, that... that is really a homogeneous blend. And see, then they're pointing out, that there isn't any spirit energy blended in there because it's non-responsive to spirit gravity. It's just mind and matter and material energy blended together. But it still is in the Father's personality circuit.
Were we teasing about the soul substance in the same context as the... the absentite nature of an angel's form. It's not threads.
Right. Like I've tried to point out, that Morantia substance, that whole hierarchy of Morantia substances, is just paralleling these homogeneous substances that you can put in a hierarchy. Down low, there's a homogeneous blend of a lot of physical energy and a little bit of spirit energy. Up high, there's a homogeneous blend of a little bit of physical energy blended into spirit energy. And there's Morantia parallels all the way up, where most of the fibers are spirit up at the top and most of the fibers are physical at the bottom, okay?
Artificial.
So if you imagine melting Morantia substance together, you'd get the forms of cherubim and seraphim and whatnot, all these, beings that are in parallel that are these homogeneous blends. And I'm just pointing out that technically, see, that kind of a homogeneous blend is an absinthite blend.
Why do you use that term? Because I think that could be confusing.
It definitely can be confusing. You've got to be really careful. They're not absinthite personalities. They're finite personalities. But the reason you use that is because think about it from our evolutionary perspective. If a seraphim is at this level, eventually we ascend up to being a Morantia being that's sort of at eye level with them, okay? Eventually you get up to their level. So as an evolutionary phenomenon, you start out with everything very, where matter, mind, and spirit are very separate. You finally get up a level where, spirit isn't so other. It's a little bit more intimate with you. You have immediate familiarity with it more. Eventually, you get up to their level. Well, see, they're just made at that level. That whole domain that's underneath them, that we experience rising up through, is eventuated into their beginning. It's bottled up into their beginning, and you can see that very literally in their nature. I mean, there really isn't such a thing as a purely finite fact. I mean, look at it from the top down. Everything is coming down from the absinthite into the finite. What you technically have is how far down into the finite does it penetrate? Does it penetrate, you have to go down a long ways to get to me? Or not so far to get to a seraphim? They all have an absinthite core. As you penetrate down into the more fundamental of the physical domain. Eventually you get to the force charge of space, which is an absinthite fact. And you can penetrate even deeper and go all the way to the unqualified absolute. I mean, everything has all finite things have an absinthite core.
Consequently, when you go from the supreme to the ultimate, you're going from the finite to the absolute.
It's why you eventually can transcend the finite. You can come into relationship with your core more. Right now, you can only know your surface. One day you'll know more of the core of your being. And one day you'll even go beyond the absonite in your core. One day you'll know the co-absolute thread at the core of your being. When we're part of the infinite all are, and the God the absolute is manifest. Okay, you have a core. And why is that fundamentally? Because the Father stuck it in you. See, that's the thing about us. We're down so far that literally within us, the core is not there. It's like an upside down iceberg where you snip the top off. It has the potential to be connected, but it's not innately connected. But a seraphim is. The seraphim is innately connected to that core. They don't have to be given some sort of a core like we do in order to be an eternal being. They're obviously connected to eternity. They don't die. See, so there has to be a core that goes from the finite up to the absolute, up to the absolute, or they wouldn't be eternal beings. We are not eternal beings until we fuse with that core that is connected to eternity. So, again, it's just, to understand things from the top down. But just, to appreciate, that's what absonite is about. It's when you don't have such a distinctiveness where there's just these three energies that you can talk about. And they are, like they point out a couple spots in the book. This isn't just a useful designation to talk about it as threefold. They are distinct, okay? If there wasn't something transcendent of matter, mind, and spirit wouldn't know each other existed. Matter is separate from mind, period. There's no innate relationship between the two of them because at the absolute level, they're absolutely separate. The absolute mind is absolutely separate from the absolute of matter. There's absolutely no relationship between the two of them. It's like, how come we don't have three universes then? One that's nothing but matter, and one that's nothing but mind, and one that's nothing but spirit. Because there's something that's super absolute. Something that bridges the gap between that distinction. Something that links mind to matter, or matter to mind, and mind to spirit. What is that links those together? The mother does. Yeah. That's what links those things together. And fundamentally, the Paradise Trinity underneath the mother. That's what links those things together. See, so that's what we're talking about. When you go up from into the absonite, you don't just have these three things. You have 20, okay, fundamentally. I'm pushing it a little bit there. We don't have, we have two triodities that give us these three things right now. That's the point. Right now we just have two triodities that give us this threefold energy. There you have 20 triodities. And so you have this much more multidimensional space. And when you look, if you just write them down, those other 18 triodities, you see what they are. They're these different blends. For instance, one of them is, say, where you take the actuality of mind energy and the actuality of material energy combined with the potential for spirit energy. And that gives you something. There's nine of them that have two actuals and a potential. There's nine of them that have one actual and two potentials. See, and then there's the two finite triodities where it's just three potentials and three actuals. Okay. Those other ones are all these cross terms, all these blends, where you take, say, the potential for spirit substance and you actualize that potential relative to the actuals of mind and matter, instead of actualizing that potential relative to the actual of spirit, which gives us what we know as spirit substance. But if you actualize that potential relative to like mind and matter actuals, what do you get? Well, you get one of these dimensions or facets of absonite energy blends. Okay, there's all these different ways, and that's, see, that's what they're alluding to there. See, like I was pointing out, this is something that, you know, that has some sort of a mind matter actuality blended together phase. And I don't know, is it because it started with the potential for mind and the potential for matter relative to the actual of spirit? Or did it start with the actual of mind and the actual of matter relative to the potential of spirit? I don't know. But
you know you can get 18.
But you know you've got all these different, yeah, these 18 different.
That's probably why they don't, is this the people they talk about that they don't usually talk,
right,
talk
right.
to you about until your universe is enlightened?
Oh, yeah, right. Well, there's that, yeah. Oh, and I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, another one that obviously goes with the Transcendentalists, you know, very much is that Consummator of Universe Destiny. See, that's going to be another one. This is not going to be normally revealed.
Right.
Okay. Anyway, I know this is a little bit overwhelming, so we don't. Yeah, we better let's move on here. But I wanted to get that's the spirit of what's going on in this paragraph. This is a really kind of fun paragraph to play with and begin to appreciate. Oh, there's just one last little thing. Why did they say no entity has personality unless he is endowed with it by God, who is spirit? Why did they kind of throw in that and say it that way, where you could understand even from a biblical perspective? You know. God is spirit. Because remember, personality is spirit pattern. I mean, that's the way you can quickly understand what they're saying here. I mean, personality is spirit pattern. If there isn't any spirit there, I mean, how am I going to apply personality to it? Right? There has to be spirit, because it's spirit pattern. You know, so when it's us, the only way we can get personality bestowed on us, can't do it when we're just a matter. You can't even do it when we're just mind-seated on that matter. That mind has got to go up from the first ajna all the way up to the seventh ajna. Until you get encircuited in the Holy Spirit, then personality can engage it because it's spirit pattern.
It can be patterns.
Yeah, it can't pattern something that's an amoeba,
say. You
can't
really have personality until you have...
Personality doesn't engage you until roughly age six. Yeah.
Let me ask you this then.
Yeah.
Where was Michael's personality for the first 5 years of his life?
Yeah.
Where was he?
Yeah. Where was he?
Do you think
there's maybe mystery to the incarnation?
Yeah.
Perhaps?
Scenario.
Right. I mean, fundamentally,
who
is managing that? We've talked about this before. You know who's managing that process. That's the mother that's managing that process. It's just like, who's managing me before my personality, my unique personality engages my energy system when it finally has some spirit energy to it so it can engage it? There's this very unique personality, creative mother spirit, a third source personality, a very unique third source personality, who can play the role of that initial faint flicker of purposing, of personality, for every creature in her local universe, every mortal creature in her super universe, prior to the father's personality engaging. Prior to roughly age six, you need a little bit of kind of transcendent purposing applied to you. She's a person. She does it. She's a special person that can purpose you so that when your personality engages, it's seamless. It's as if your personality was already there. Okay, and how can she do that?
The Holy Spirit.
Because again, she has super absolute nature. Remember, that absoluteness of distinction of personality, she's above that. She can connect two absolutely distinct personalities together. So she can play that role. She can function as if she were you before you were you, in a personal sense. And you before you were you, and you before you, and every single mortal in the local universe. She can guide them. You know, obviously it doesn't need a lot. I mean, there's not a lot of personality needed, you know, in those early years. But what subtle is needed in some transcendent way, she does. And so when the father's personality finally identifies with you, you know, she lets go. You know, there's a handoff. And it's seamless. It's just as if the Father had always been guiding it.
Well, what exactly gets recorded at birth then? The personality recorders are recording what?
You're a potentially separate personality there.
Okay, potential personality.
Because you have been physically disconnected from your mother.
Okay.
You're materially independent. Until you're a materially independent blob, you're not a, you can't be put on there in any potential fashion. Yeah. Okay.
I just have to say that if personality is also described as being superordinate, okay, something really that is above spirit, then it's an attenuation to say that it is spirit pattern in such a way that it is just spirit pattern.
The challenge is to flip your picture around, see it in a different way, so you don't have a paradox.
Okay.
Right. So for the people on the webinar, what Andre was trying to point out there is that if it's just a mindful same physical energy personalities they were just describing there, if it's non-responsive to spirit gravity, to say that can be a personality and that personality is a spirit pattern, isn't that nonsensical? But remember, you are not responsive to spirit gravity,
and
you're a personality.
Yeah.
It's the exact same thing. Okay, it's just recognizing that the only way that you can have this relationship to personality as a material identity is because you've gone all the way up through mind energy until finally it can be encircled in the Holy Spirit. And those adjutants can be transformed into have a spirit-like flavor. Like, for instance, the seventh can be the spirit of worship instead of just the energy of symmetry. It can be more than just a differential urge. It can be the philosophic impulse. It can be more than an energy. This is why you can be personalized. And the extremely important thing about getting a father fragment, a spirit fragment, put in your mind, not above your mind, like the Holy Spirit and the Spirit of Truth are above your mind, but to have a literal spirit fragment within your mind, that spirit fragment feels spirit gravity. And it is locked onto your mind. So now your mind feels spirit gravity. So that's why they say when you have an adjuster, your personality has a much greater potential to manifest because as a spirit pattern, it now has something much more substantive in the way of your spiritness to engage and express through. The adjuster spiritizes you more. Okay? Remember how they talk about it realityizing you. Personality engaging your actuality is your reality. See, you can be more realityized because of that spirit fragment. You ascend when you have a spirit fragment because spirit gravity pulls the spirit fragment up. That's why you ascend. If you don't have a spirit fragment, you can't ascend because there's no spirit gravity to pull you up. All there is material gravity keeping you down. So it's in that sense, that in the lower domain of the hourglass, you have adjutant mind. In the upper domain, you have spiritualized mind. It's not spirit, but it is spiritualized mind. It has enough, even without an adjuster, that a personality can make an initial tentative engagement to it. But remember, in the eyes of the universe, they don't consider you to have an identity until you get an adjuster. Okay, what is an identity? An identity is an actuality that has a personality identified with it. A self becomes an identity, a mindful self becomes an identity when it's realityized, when pattern engages it, when it's a personalized self. See, so in the eyes of the universe, they don't consider this initial tentative relationship that we have without an adjuster of a personality to this mindful self, they don't consider that really valid. You aren't considered to have an identity in the eyes of the universe until you have something that's literally a spirit substance that that personality is, you know, at least indirectly related to, then they'll say, okay, now you have an identity.
However,
but
you get an identity whether you like it or not, I think, because of the love of your parents, and that's a different kind of identity.
Right. See, but see, in the sense of the Urantia book, when they use that word, it's a very technical term. See,
they compensate that.
Right. You're a potential identity. You know, prior to being an actual identity in the eyes of the universe. What's resurrected on the probationary nursery? A potential identity. It literally says that, okay? It's just a potential identity. We have to recognize, let me just jump a gun a second. We went through that whole paradise list and mortals weren't in that list. Okay, we're not going to do it tonight, but next time we'll go through a whole nother list, the universal list. And guess what? Mortals aren't in that list either. So they go. You go through these two vast lists and go, what about me? And they go, well, you need to understand, Chris, that you're a potential right now. Okay? I mean, if you go, remember what they tell you up in the adjuster papers. Human subjects are often known by the numbers of their adjusters. Mortals do not receive real universe names until after adjuster fusion, which union is signalized by the bestowal of the new name upon the new creature of the Destiny Guardian. I mean, so...
But there's a balance there, I think, between, yes, that's true, between faith in your own potential or faith in the other potential that... Yes, you may not have technically gotten there yet, but
what do they call you before you're an ascending son? You're a faith son.
Faith son.
Right. See, exactly what you're saying is true. Right. Right? That's why you're called a faith son, and you know when you're feeling like you need to be more substantive than what I'm talking about, this is where you need to remind yourself of how God views you. From the eyes of the Father, is there any difference at all between a potential and an actual?
No.
None. Zero difference between a potential and an actual. A potential is just as literal as an actual from the Father's perspective. So I can recognize that by and large, I am nothing but a potential. I'm an unfertilized egg, and yet I cannot feel one shred of diminishment in my relationship to God. When I recognize it about by nature, because I know God views me as an eternalizer. My potential is just as solid as any actual I'll have as a co-absolute being in His relationship to me. It's just as solid. I don't have to self-aggrandize. I don't have to be delusional and exalt myself above what I actually am.
Fear not.
Yeah? Fear not. God has a hold of a solid thing. But technically, down in the finite here, we're a long ways away from even being worthy of having a name in the eyes of the universe. I mean, think about a sun-fused mortal. He goes all the way up to Salvington without a name.
And is the difference between an actual and a potential that until you become an actual, there's always the possibility that you could default or choose not to survive.
Right. Yeah, from a finite point of view, that's what we mean by the difference between potential and, yeah. I mean, you're not actually part of eternity until you've fused with a fragment of eternity, the adjuster. Until then, you're not actually part of eternity, and only beings that are part of eternity have names. Because the person that names them is in eternity, right? See, so.
But it's still far afield from the question of personality, because the personality record keepers, again, you emphasize the idea of looking literally at what the book is saying.
Right.
And when it's saying that the personality record keepers record personality from birth till it's blotted out of recorded existence or leaves the local universe. I mean,
and I just explained how you can do that.
I know you did, but you did it in such a way that what it's doing is it's not taking it literally. And why are they saying literally that the personality record keepers?
Right.
Why would they record personality?
I mean, we can't. I can't convince you of that. In 5 minutes right now.
Well,
just I'm putting that forward. That is the understanding that you can come to. It's up to you to take it or leave it.
Okay.
If you reject that, that's fine. But your challenge then, you should know, is to come up with a self-consistent rationalization.
Well, technically, it says the personality record keepers, but it says they're just recording each mortal.
Yeah.
I just had a huge discussion on this week.
There's a whole bunch of things that you can notice, but the truth is not in the minutia like that. Don't rely on finding that sentence that has that word that you can hang your whole picture on. There is no truth in the words of the Urantia book. They tell you point blank. Truth is not in words. The truth in this revelation can't be read. When I'm talking about things like I'm talking about something that can't be read. What can be read are two things. Something that if you start with one initial assumption will refute the truth, and something if you start at the opposite initial assumption will confirm the truth. See, that's the thing about it. Yeah, we're talking about things that can't be read. It's about things that you come to discover, that the self-consistent picture is that personality doesn't technically engage until roughly age 6. And they want you to come to terms with how not innately divine that makes us. We start as far from divinity as you can get. We start so far from divinity that at birth, we aren't technically even a person. We're a potential person. It's like, well, then why use the word personality? Because who gives me that my personality? The Universal Father. And is there any difference between potential and actual in the Universal Father? Not one iota. See, we're trying to come to, we have to view it both top down and bottom up. Top down, I'm a person, I guess before time began, because that's when my personality was individuated by the Father. There wasn't even a super universe when he gave me my personality. That's how potential I was. That's technically when he bestowed my personality upon me. It was before time began. Before there was a Havona even, he gave me my personality. Talk about being a potential. That's how potential I was. I wasn't even a glimmer in the eyes of the architects yet.
Because if it wasn't, you weren't a potential to begin with.
But see,
from a
temporal point of view, so from an eternity, I'm a person in eternity. And there is no time. But in time, you've got to take into account these details. You can't force time to be eternity. It's not. If you force time to be eternity, you'll get logical paradoxes. Philosophers for the last 2,600 years have done this a number of times. I've been pointing this out to people who are taking the philosophy class. You see when St. Augustine tries to make time eternity, he comes up with a theory of time that's illogical. Okay? If you try to make, the bestowing of personality in eternity this equal to the bestowing of personality in time, if you make time eternity, you'll create an illogical cosmos. You can't do that. You've got to separate them. And your spiritual consciousness does not like that. It will not like being separated from personality for 6 years. Even though you're long past being 6 years old now. It does not like it retroactively. It will hate it. It will detest that thought. That somehow I wasn't born innately divine. I mean, let's take it to the next step. Forget about when you put personality engaging the actuality in time. Think about what personality is in and of itself. It's pure potential. Okay, there's not a shred of actuality to personality when it comes to the Father. It's a pure potential. Okay, so when you recognize it's a pure potential, isn't it more logical that what it should engage with is a potential and not an actual? See, it's like to like. You're a potential personality. It's the potential to actualize personality, to be a volitional being. And the two potentials come together. And there's a super additive consequence of the first threads of the actualization of will, of volition. A mind of will dignity, a volitional being. I mean, that's another...
When a person doesn't choose to survive, that personality trait stays with the thought adjuster, right?
Because that potential to purpose is eternal and can't go anywhere.
Yeah, it can't just disappear.
Right.
Well, we don't know where the personality goes.
Yes, we do.
Not kept with the angel.
No. It's absorbed.
No, in that sense. Well, where was it before? Where was your personality a million years ago? It's when you between your death and your resurrection, it's in the same place as it was a million years ago. In the ubiquitous person, potential presence that is the Father. He's a presence of potential. Remember, we just read about like a spirit presence. I mean, the Eternal Mother, Son, and the Infinite Mother Spirit are actual presences. The Father is a potential presence. He's just here as a potential because he's the initiator. He gives you that individuation of potential, and you're initiated. Immediately when that potential comes into relationship with your energy system, that potential begins to actualize. All right. Let's read that. Right, I mean, there's a number of these details that they are very different than any historical perspective, and that's the point. I'm challenging them aggressively because the whole point is to not put new wine in old wineskins. If we think about personality in a way that St. Augustine did, we're going to make the same mistakes that St. Augustine made. We want to get past his mistakes. We want to get past all of St. Paul's mistakes.
We've got to
change the way we look at things. And it's not important just to have a logical cosmology. If you don't change it, you have the dangers of Lucifer in play. If you don't believe that that personality is pure potential, then you believe the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. That's his third principle, that there is no potential to this stuff. It's all actual. You're innately divine. That's his thesis. It's the beginning of the end to think that. You want to embrace the absolute humility of starting out as pure potential and getting to paradise because of not one iota of what you are, but of what God is. He does everything. All you do is allow him to do it. Remember what it says when they talk about Machiavelli and Melchizedek? Okay? That's the whole point.
He makes you think you do it.
The faith grasp a hold of the potential by faith alone, right? That was the whole point of the third epical revelation. That you're saved by faith. All you have to do is just grab that potential. And God sees to the actualization of it from here to eternity. You don't have to do anything else. Just let it actualize. All you have to do is choose to be a conduit of actualization. But if you say, no, I'm not a conduit of actualization. I'm an actuality. I'm like one of the absolute actuals. Well, you're going to get to a surprise point somewhere in the future where you are as if you never had been born, where you cease to exist. Because, why are you as if you've never been born? It's because you may have said you're an actual, but you're not. You're a potential. That's why you can be as if you never were born. You never actualized. I never knew you, the Father says. Those that cried, Lord, Lord. And he said, I never knew you. That's what he means by it. It's literal. I only know an actual. You were just a potential, delusionally calling yourself an actual. I never knew you. There was nothing to know. You refused to let God actualize you. You assumed that you were actual. I never knew you, it says.
It's a little, getting from here to paradise is a little bit more than just like grabbing onto a strap in a train and hanging on for dear life and letting it take you. I mean, there's an awful lot of work that has to be done.
Right. But how, what begins it is just
choosing is
just that consecration of will.
Yeah, and beyond that, then boy, oh boy. Is
right. There's that whole process of consecrating the mind.
That's the marvel.
You know, there's only so much you can actualize in a little embryonic mind. So you have to take the light and cultivating, having a bigger capacity, and then more can actualize through it. You know, there is that, right?
Remember when Jesus came down and he, from his 40 days, and he said that he was going to start quietly preaching the gospel and letting his thought adjuster work out the details day by day, or which was sort of interesting in the way of letting God actualize his life and go about doing what.
Right. I mean, what do they tell you in the adjuster papers? The adjuster comes with the plan. Not a plan, the plan. Okay?
You know that old joke. It's like the test. If it weren't a test, you'd have been given instructions. Right. No, it's kind of like that.
You don't have any part in how you get to paradise. There's only one way, the plan. You either follow the plan or you don't get to paradise. That's just the way it is. Okay, last little bit, and then we'll wrap it up.
These papers do not, cannot, even begin to exhaust the story of the living creatures, creators, eventuators, and still otherwise existent beings who live and worship and serve in the swarming universes of time and in the central universe of eternity. You mortals are persons, hence we can describe beings who are personalized. But how could an absonitized being ever be explained to you?
Can be explained directly, but you can understand what they're talking about. Okay, again, this is, not only do you have those other 18 triodities relative to the absonite, but you have 8 triunities relative to the absonite. One of those other 8 triunities is the triunity that's involved in bestowing the absonite pattern. And for the relative to the finite, there's the first two triunities bestow, the first one bestows spirit pattern, the second one bestows energy pattern. Those first two triunities. You know, for the two substances, there's the two patterns. So spirit pattern, personality is bestowed by the first triunity. Energy pattern, or just pattern, as we normally call it, in contrast to personality, that's bestowed by the second. One of those 8 absonite triunities bestows personality pattern, the hyphen there between. personality power, I should say, probably. You know, it's absonite pattern. That's a being is absonitized when what's bestowed upon them is not spirit pattern or energy pattern, but absonite pattern. That's what they mean by absonitized. So this right now, you think about going up to the Supreme as a power personality synthesis, where it's in that order. You get to the other side, you reciprocate that. And there's one spot in the book where they give you it in the other order. Instead of power personality, it's personality power. That's the kind of pattern that you have that can be bestowed on. And so that brings in the question, it's like, well, is that the kind of pattern, the kind of purposing that's bestowed on, say, the master architect? Or are there other issues in play? I don't know. But that's what they mean by absonitized.
Okay, what do they mean by still otherwise existent beings? Is that something different that they don't even know of?
Oh, an example. Okay, so you have creatures, creators, eventuators.
They're not explaining.
You have a being that's eternalized into existence. For instance, the consummator of universe destiny. It was eternalized into existence, and if he you know, does things like relative to creating and eventuating, then you would say he was eternalizing. He was an internalizer.
Or maybe a trinitized being of some kind. It's a different
kind. Right, and then, you know, there is that that you can bring in too. That
it's so great the way they love, they live, they worship, and they serve. Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of an interesting.
Right, to just remind you that no matter. See, notice how that's kind of like what they did, where it got a little bit poetic when they were talking about the Father, like I said, you know, at the end of last time. You see the same thing there. They're trying to remind you, it's like, wow, we're talking about all this complicated stuff, I'm getting kind of confused and stuff. No, it's, no matter if you, it doesn't matter if you're talking about the consummator of universe destiny, and he's, you know, if you'd figure out that he's co-absolute, and you figure out what kind of deities, you know, is personalized, and all this sort of stuff, he still is a lot like you. You can understand it. They live and worship and serve. The consummated universe, that destiny worships the Father, just like you do.
That's cool.
Right. And he serves, you know, in ways we can't even imagine. I mean, he has to serve the co-absolute capacity. I mean, there's this incredible service.
He's holding on to the strap, too.
Okay. They're a living thing. They're made out of very fancy stuff, but they're still a living thing that's been personalized, and it worships the Father who personalized him, and et cetera, and they serve. You know, I mean, think about how transcendent the core of the fourth epical revelation is, loving service. You know, I mean, are you going to outgrow that? No. You outgrow just those initial things of trust and faith from the third. But you're not going to outgrow love and service. That's why there's a fourth epical revelation. You know, now you got yourself started with trust and faith. Now do something with it. Love and service. You know, turn the noun into a verb. One must do something as well as be something. But once you've got that, I mean, you've got it. That's the essence of everything, all the way to the end of ends. It's just in a more and more complex context involving more and more beings and more whatnot, but it's the same basic idea, loving service from here to eternity. So, you know, that's why, you know, when you think of him as a spiritual uplifter, and you think of it in a simple terms of matter, mind, spirit, it's like, well, the spirit's a ceiling. Yeah, you see that. See, as a spiritual uplifter, he's kind of giving you the end from the beginning. You don't really need to know much else besides loving service. You just need to know the details of who you're going to love and how you're going to serve. That's the only thing that changes. And it'll be just the same when you are a super personality, a super creature, an absentite being. You know, and you're rubbing elbows with the Supreme Being, you know, working on things together with the Supreme Being. And, just think about how wild that'll be when, you know, when the Supreme Being isn't something off in the distance, but he's someone that's standing on the plane with you. You know? Yeah. Just like they tell you, you get up to the constellation level. You work your way through all the satellites and sub-satellites, but you finally get to be a citizen of Edentia, and you'll actually be working with the Most Highs, doing Most High things. Or you get up to Uversa. Remember when we read that? You'll actually get to do Ancient of Days things. You'll get to work side by side with God. He'll trust you to be his adjutant.
Consider that the Ancients of Days took recognition of Amadon directly.
Right. They're going, wow, I can hardly wait for him to get here. Do I have something for him to do? I'm going to hand him great responsibility, and he's going to execute it perfectly. I have too many things to do. I'd love to be able to delegate, say, the Ancients of Days. Please rise up to the level where I can delegate something that normally I do to you. You're not going to be God But you're divine enough that you can do the kind of things that God does even at universal level. That's a pretty amazing thought.
Pretty amazing.
That, and we kind of, you know, we mentioned that in passing. That was like, whoa, this really profound statement that they just, you know, threw at you.
We're not adequate to provide any measure of self-importance. We need some real self-importance to step into in our selfhood.
Yeah, and the fact that they tell you things like that, how dangerous is that? How could that, how much could that go to your head right now? That's why it's so important to just pound yourself down into humility, to not let even a hint of spiritual pride in. You know, there was nothing that Jesus was harsher on than that. The moment he saw one of his disciples or apostles or evangelists even hinting of that, he just hit him with a sledgehammer. I mean, you do not want one shred. The pride has no place. You know, don't let ethnic pride or, you know, anything like it. Pride is a word that, you know, that goeth before the fall and nothing else.
Doesn't mean you can't have confidence.
You can have self-esteem.
Right, yeah. Self-respect. Worthiness and things like that.
Can you be proud?
But you got to be careful. Even with self-esteem, I mean, you know, there's a hierarchy. You don't want self-admiration. The reason I said you can have self-esteem, that's there's still a negativity there that you need to work on. You need to drop it down to self-respect. Self-esteem is on the fifth level, and it's quasi-dangerous. But it's a decent first step if your initial instinct is to have self-admiration, self-love, to go the whole full-blown Lucifer direction. At least drop it down a notch and think of it as self-esteem, and then work on the next level of humility and get it down to self-respect, because that's where
so
it belongs.
Many people teach self-love.
Yeah.
But I don't think they mean it the Lucifer way.
They don't. Really. They don't. But it's just like many religionists are unwitting secularists. That there's a danger in play that they often point out. It's like, you know, that all starts out innocently, but so did Lucifer. You got to be really careful with that.
It's probably meant more to be to realize that you are loved than to...
Yeah, but see, it's so easy if you don't have a rock-solid God picture so that you know where that love
right.
you know, came from and where it should be directed to, that it's going to become self-love.
Yeah.
It's a dicey thing.
Yeah. Rampant.
Yeah, and it's very rampant. You know, that's why there's a book in my lap. There's an emergency in play. We're starting to play with fire, the same fire that Lucifer and crew played with, because we're finally spiritual enough now that we can do dangerous things with ourselves. Blobs of protoplasm can't become
Jesus
iniquitous.
Said, I think more people are weak than wicked, so to speak, that they just
right.
don't get
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
And they that's so
right.
they strike they're reaching out for something and that's all they can reach out for in a secular situation.
Yeah.
You know, I think their heart or their desire is
the right and that's way. Why there's not a spiritual emergency, what you're just saying there. They're weak and not wicked. I mean the emergency is not an individual one. I mean I'm too ignorant by and large to become iniquitous. But I'm spiritual enough that I can be a seed of chaos sown into civilization. You know, the emergency is a collective one. We're on the verge of civilizational collapse if we don't get some nuggets of wisdom and truth re-solidified here to hold civilization together. Civilization has to be chosen. You know, like they said, we're not lost in the theologic sense, but we are lost in the directional sense, the philosophic sense. So, you know, to keep those separate, you know, that fortunately for most people as individuals, we're too ignorant to reach iniquity in this short life. You just don't know enough about reality to de-realityize yourself. but boy, we could really, you know, we're causing a lot of problems with civilization. Okay, we better wrap it up there. Okay, let's take a moment here and reflect on this.